This is Hacker Public Radio episode 3249 for Thursday the 14th of January 2021. Today's show is entitled, Linux In-Laws S01E21, The Big Linux In-Laws Peep Show, and is part of the series, Linux In-Laws. It is hosted by Monochrome, and is about 53 minutes long, and carries an explicit flag. The summary is, the two chaps go the full Monty, and reveal it all.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
This is Linux In-Laws, a podcast on topics around free and open source software, any associated contraband, communism, the revolution in general, and whatever else fancies your tickle. Please note that this and other episodes may contain strong language, offensive humor, and other certainly not politically correct language. You have been warned. Our parents insisted on this disclaimer. Happy Mum! Thus, the content is not suitable for consumption in the workplace, especially when played back on a speaker in an open plan office or similar environments. Any minors under the age of 35, or any pets, including fluffy little killer bunnies, your trusted guide dog, unless on speed, and cute T-Rexes or other associated dinosaurs.
Due to shortcomings with Martin's audio configuration, some parts of the podcast may be of suboptimal sound quality. Full marks have to go to the In-Laws post-production crew to salvage what could be salvaged, but unfortunately the sound quality you've come to expect from Linux In-Laws is not up to scratch with this episode, for which the In-Laws would like to apologize.
This is Linux In-Laws Season 1, Episode 21, The Big Linux In-Laws Peep Show. Martin, how are things?
Hey, good morning, Chris. Things are fine and dandy and cold and snowy and...
Even in this...
The whole of last year.
Even in these corona-ridden times.
Yeah, nothing has changed from that perspective. Just haven't been
okay.
From last year.
Right. But you have some vacation coming up, no?
Possibly. It depends.
Well, I keep my fingers crossed.
Today is yet another announcement day, so let's see.
Is it? What's going to be announced? Lizzie stepping down finally? Boris doing the same? No, that sort of thing?
The usual corona briefing by the PM. Every time they make some changes.
I see. But this is not the subject of today's episode, because today's episode... No, it's not, Martin, in contrast to popular belief. No, it's not, Martin. This is not a corona show. As a matter of fact, it's called the Linux In-Laws Peep Show for a reason, because today's subject, yes, is actually how to take a look at your system in terms of the fun stuff you always wanted to know about debugging, tracing, monitoring Linux. Well, not monitoring, but rather focuses actually on tracing and debugging. But we're always afraid to ask. So, Martin, why don't we get started with...
Yeah, I have a question for you.
Oh, by all means,
yes, why don't we get started? Getting started is a good idea.
Excellent.
It's a bit tricky.
Welcome to Linux in Laws Season 1, Episode 21. Yes, Martin. You had a question, sorry.
Yeah, so when would one want to do tracing?
Well, when one wants to find something out about the system. Okay, the big picture. Tracing is essentially the idea of to take a look at. No, that's not proper English. Tracing is essentially following the execution of a program, right? From various aspects. Whereas debugging basically takes that concept one step further in terms of you can set breakpoints, you can inspect variables, you can set watchpoints, all the rest of it. And of course, Linux especially has quite a significant tool chain around this. Full caveat, people, we won't go through the low-level technical details because that's exactly what web pages and man pages are for. The purpose of this episode is rather to give you a kind of a short overview of what you have at your disposal focusing on Linux. Some of the stuff is also available on other systems like OS X and so forth. So we should be able to keep this episode to the absolute minimum, the usual 2.5 hours. I think
it may be a bit of a bumper on this one.
So, Martin, why don't you get us started basically with debuggers?
Debuggers. Well, so, I mean, it depends what kind of programming you do, right? Okay.
Old school.
Back to the beginning.
Exactly. Old school C type stuff.
We're working on some premises here that people are actually writing not low level.
Yes.
Not programming in Python or Java or C++.
Correct. Why don't we basically take a step back and take a look at where it all started with an operating system called Unix, which of course was at the time, for the time being, back in the 70s, closed source. And I think originally authored by a company or by a bunch of people working at a company called AT&T. And they had this great idea of doing this actually in a low-level programming language called C, which, funny enough, after 50 years in the making is still around, because if you take a look at GitHub, you will find out that quite a few projects, I don't know the exact percentage, but my guess would be that at least a third, if not half, maybe somewhere in between, of the code out on GitHub and similar platforms is still in C. Or some derivative, like C++ and stuff.
What about the Linux kernel itself? How much of that is C?
I suppose... even with the advent of Rust crates and so forth for driver development, details in the show notes, I would reckon that my guess would be around, 96-97%? The Linux kernel is structured, of course, into a machine-dependent part, where the low-level stuff is really living, like the hardware exception layer. And then the rest is basically written in C. There is, in contrast to popular belief, there is no single piece of C++ code in the Linux kernel. Linus was straightforward and quite clear about this in the, I think, late 90s, that no portion of the kernel would ever be written in C++. For a number of reasons, you'll find the details in the show notes. Essentially, he doesn't see the advantages, or he didn't see the advantages, and I think that's still valid today. For writing portions of the kernel in C++. So the kernel itself is written in C and machine dependent assembler as such. And of course, the first abstraction running on top of the kernel is something called glibc, also known as libc in other operating systems. And essentially it's the layer that talks to, that talks to the kernel. Like opening files, allocating memory, and all the rest of it. Or rather, kind of accessing files, not just opening it. So let's go back to how would you program a C?
I still want to know why.
Software. Funny enough, because...
If you're developing C, fair enough.
Well, software is written by humans, right?
Some of it is, yeah.
And funny enough, these people make mistakes when they write software.
Yeah, we should do away with them. If you want to sponsor a cyber dive, feel free.
Yes, Skynet, why don't you get in touch? The address is, yes. The address is sponsors@linuxinlaws.eu. Okay. Right. No, jokes aside. So of course, and that probably includes you as well, Martin. If you write a program, it's never bug free from day one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the reason why you use GDB, LLDB, and friends to ensure that you actually debug. And this is actually a clue, is in the name, that you actually get rid of the bugs in the program. And this is exactly why you use debuggers for.
Right.
Yes, Martin. There you go. So getting up early has already paid off for Martin. Never mind liquid alcoholic refreshments or not at 10 a.m. in the morning. Anyway.
It's only 9 here. Carry on. Yep.
So, and of course, two famous debuggers come to mind. Something called GDB, which is the GNU debugger, and the latest addition, I think, to that game is actually something called LLDB from the LLVM project.
Right.
Okay. LLVM, of course, standing for low-level virtual machine. Mm. Essentially, it's a... What's the word I'm looking for? It's not a counter project, but rather it's a counter... Something or other to the GNU compiler collection.
Okay.
As in a compiler collection with various front ends, and C-Lang would be one of them for C and C++, that basically allows the transformation of C code into machine instructions. Mm-hmm. And of course, they also have their own debugger called LLDB, also, by the way, used in something called the Rust toolchain, because essentially, if you take a look at the standard Rust compiler implementation, this is actually based on LLVM. So the debugger of choice for serious Rust programming would, of course, be LLDB in this case.
Okay.
And the usual functionality, of course, is present in both debugger types or debugger implementations, let's put it this way. Like certain breakpoints, basically where you tell the program when to stop. So once you set a breakpoint, the program execution stops, and then you can split variables, registers, and so forth.
Yep. Okay, good stuff. So that's really talking about the debugging side of... you can carry on a bit about that in a minute. But there are also other purposes why one might want to do inspections of running code, I assume, with your security background.
Well, to ensure that there's a minimal attack surface, as in, if you fuzz a program, basically, you want to know why it's breaking, how it's breaking. Sorry, fuzzing a program, of course, means pumping input values into a piece of software that would have the potential to make it break. Because, for example, there's input validation missing, i.e., you don't take a look at the data that is fed into a program, but rather you just try to process it based on your algorithms. Because what you normally would do is basically, in order to ensure sanity of a piece of software, or data rather, entering that code base, is actually what you would actually take a look at the input data in terms of validating it, making sure that it adheres to the formal criteria that you hopefully specified, and also making sure that the data entered makes sense in terms of it's valid, that sort of thing. And of course, you can also do that with a debugger.
Someone else's programming skills, abilities, whatever, pass their input variables, I guess.
Yes. And one important thing that both debuggers actually support is actually you can attach to an already running program that comes in handy, for example, if you are debugging daemons and server pieces of software.
Okay.
Assuming that, of course, you have the necessary privileges, needless to say, being an ordinary user, attaching to a server that is running as root and then trying to inspect its variables and stuff might be very tricky, for a reason, of course.
Well, I think tricky is probably an understatement here. No?
Well, there's a reason why Linux explicitly forbids this. So if you want to debug an already running server with a particular running as root, needless to say, you have to be root yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Goes without saying.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted your debugging.
No, that was pretty much it. I mean, the usual, and you'll see this actually with any debugger, not just related to GDB or LDB. Mm. You have the usual functionality at your disposal, like inspecting variables, modifying variables, setting breakpoints, setting watch points where you, the difference, of course, between a breakpoint and a watch point. And the difference between a breakpoint and a watch point is that a breakpoint always interrupts the flow of the execution in a program, whereas the watch point simply prints out the contents, for example, of a variable, but continues the program execution. It's handy basically when you just want to take a look at how a variable is behaving when you execute a program.
Mm-hmm.
That's the main difference.
For the hipster Java programmers amongst us who want to venture into this area. Are there any plugins for, say, I don't know, their favorite UIs to run a GDB? Because last time I used it was like 20 years ago. It's all command line. But,
I thought you were the Java fanboy among us. No, no, Martin, what has changed?
Fan is a, yeah, quite a contradiction in terms, but that's it.
Of course, you do have, the usual, what's what I'm looking for, integrated development environments like Eclipse and so forth would have their own debuggers built into the toolchain. Even, I think OpenJDK supports something called JDB, where you can, similar to GDB or LLDB, where you can basically inspect the compiled program running on a JVM at runtime, so the functionality is comparable to other debuggers.
Yes, but if you wanted to say do the same for GDB and use your favorite GUI for this, what would you use, or is this available?
Of course, the normal IDEs like CDT, for example, for Eclipse, which is essentially a development environment for C and C++ programmers running top of Eclipse would access the existing debuggers like GDB and LLDB from a GUI perspective as a graphical user interface. So you would have full integration of set debuggers in your IDE.
Okay.
Similar to PyCharm. Yes, similar to PyCharm, of course, you can invoke the standard Python debugger, which is called PDB, from your ordinary GUI. That means you have all the semantic, all the niceties, let's put it this way, all the goodies in your GUI, in your IDE. You don't have to resort to the command line, but seriously, people, who wants to use IDEs for debugging programs, right? I mean, we leave that to the hipster generation. we are quite old, so yes, we have grown up with the command line. And funny enough, if I'm doing work on embedded systems, which I do quite a lot, as a matter of fact, the only tools at my disposal is actually a C compiler in the shape of GCC. Or something else, and then maybe Emacs, and of course GDB or some other command line oriented debugger. The beauty is, even if you SSH into an embedded system where you don't have an IDE at your disposal, you simply can do this on the command line. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, this command line is obviously always available, which is rather handy.
And that hasn't really changed for the last 50 plus years.
No, all this fancy GUI stuff that was this. Yeah, I remember when it came out. When was that? '90s.
Turbo Pascal came out in the '80s, actually, and that I think was the first ASCII or terminal-based IDE for something called Turbo Pascal.
Turbo Pascal, yeah, okay.
Because this is what I used when I was at uni, and that goes back to the mid '80s.
You used Turbo Pascal at uni? Wow. Okay.
You didn't?
No, just normal Pascal. Actually, we start. No, we did Al Gore, actually. Anyway, this is the subject of a different episode.
Martin, I didn't know that your university days date back to the 60s. I thought we were kind of similar age.
My university was one that liked to go on principles, not on fancy.
So people, I'm sure that 20 is that the university of 20 is different these days, but in the old days, apparently, it was quite laid back when it came to fancy newfangled stuff.
Yeah, I think they had a fire a couple of years back, so the PDP 11 is probably burnt down. Probably upgraded.
Excellent. So what are they running these days? Microvaxes?
Probably.
or even some network PCs, which were all the rage in the 80s. What was it called? That thing, NetDOS or something, right? Done by Novell.
Oh my god, yes.
There was a network operating system, but I can't remember the name. If I feel like it, you have the links in the show notes.
I don't think there'll be many takers for that one, so I wouldn't worry too much. Right, where were we anyway? If we talk about debugging.
Debuggers, yes. So the idea is essentially you take a somewhat compiled code base and then you take a look at what's happening in that code base.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the details are a little bit programming language specific, but this is the beauty about GDB and LLDB, because you essentially tell the compiler to generate debugging information. These debugs typically know how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so say, for example, I wanted to do some debugging on ELSA. I could just hook that up and set some breakpoints, see what's going on.
ELSA, you mean the sound system?
Hmm.
Well, some of the stuff basically is running on in the kernel, like the sound drivers themselves. But mm-hmm. Needless to say, of course, you can debug any libraries as part of your user land. Goes without saying. So if you program interface directly with ELSA, if it's kind of still kind of the legacy stuff, not talking to Pulse, because you would normally use these days an audio system like Pulse or Jack if you want to do audio processing, because ELSA basically is the hardware itself, or represents the hardware itself, basically, yes, of course. You can talk directly to the ELSA API, and given the fact that this is implemented as library, you can, of course, use GDB or LDB for this, goes without saying.
Oh, there you go. So handy use.
Some word of advice, although people, especially if you're talking C or any draft language, just make sure that you use the corresponding optimization settings, because if you use the wrong optimization settings, especially if you tell the compiler to optimize the hell out of the generated machine code, you'll have funky stuff in your debugger going on, like variables not existing anymore, expressions basically going away, that sort of thing. So what I normally do is basically I either omit optimization completely, or I tell the compiler to use a very basic optimization, like in GCC, like that would be -O0, which essentially tells the compiler not to bother apart from the very basic optimizations.
Okay.
Because the more you optimize, the stranger the generated machine code will look to an ordinary debugger.
Handy tips. Right. So... Does that bring us onto tracing yet?
Well, we can. There's nothing stopping us, right? Okay. Indeed.
Handy segue.
Pun intended. So the next breakpoint, yes, would be indeed tracing. Okay, two general approaches come to mind, something called S-Trace and L-Trace. The difference, of course, being that S-Trace allows you to trace system calls. Mm-hmm. As in anything that crosses the boundary from the user land to the kernel and back. This is basically where S-Trace comes into play.
So everything that calls a glibc function, I guess.
anything that the glibc, as a matter of fact, passes on to the kernel, yes. And ltrace, of course, as the and the hint is actually the letter L here, allows you to trace lab records. So anything that passes between your program and any associated libraries that you link to can be checked out with ltrace. And the idea is that ltrace is, compared to strace, quite rather a high-level tracing tool that allows you to take a look at the flow of control between different components, different libraries that you use, whereas strace actually allows you to take a look at what's passed to the kernel and comes back. This is the main difference. Both approaches rely on something called ptrace, which is essentially a kernel capability, allowing... exactly, like process that allows a process to attach to another process. Something that also GDB uses when you want to inspect an already running piece of software. It's special capability, segue into capabilities. Capabilities essentially are, in Linux at least, special rights that a thread has, like tracing. If a thread is lacking this capability, it cannot attach to a different process for the purpose of tracing this thing. Other capabilities, for example, include the possibility to open a port with a numeric value under 1024, even if you're not running as root. So meaning if a particular executable has that capability set, you can open port 700 not being a super user. These are just two examples of capabilities found in Linux and other systems. Details are, of course, in the show notes. And just basically to conclude the segue now, these capabilities on a file level are normally included in the extended attributes of a file. Again, the details you'll find in the show notes.
Okay. They are actually quite useful. Yeah, it's they are quite useful, number one stuff on 1024 as a good example.
Of course, it does depend on the file system supporting these extended attributes. Not every file system supports these, but in the Linux world, at least the ext family of operating of file systems come to mind, like X2, X3, X4, that support these out of the box. And you see any newer file systems like RiseRFS, ButterFS, and all the rest of them have more often than not unlimited support in terms of the number of bytes that can comprise an extended attribute is not limited. That's what I'm saying. So, X2, 3, and 4 limit the extended file attributes, whereas the newer file systems don't. But I've yet to see a software system basically that runs into capacity issues when attaching extended file attributes to a file.
Yeah.
So these limitations are rather theoretical in nature.
Okay.
Anyway, coming back to especially strace. Strace is pretty handy if you want to know what's happening on a system level, i.e., for example, what files your program opens when it's executed.
Okay, file open, there are other tools for that as well. But what about the performance aspect of your code and debugging things, or not debugging, but measuring various latency, frequency of calls and things like that?
You can do that too, because strace simply gives you a listing of the system calls that a piece of software generates. Needless to say, yeah, there's a performance penalty that is being paid. But if you redirect the strace output to particular files, like there's a command line switch for that called -o, it goes directly into file and is not being displayed on the console. Meaning, yes, you have a performance impact, but this is not that big. strace comes in handy, especially if you want to take a look at what's happening inside a code base, inside a software, where you don't necessarily have access to the source code for. Because normally, of course, you could expect the source code, but if that source code for whatever reason is not available, but you still want to see what's going on, Strace is your friend.
Yeah, and it also, well, I mean, the difference between looking at source code and the running program is obviously that you can get your the number of calls to various functions and where the time is spent. Right now.
Also, a nice feature of Strace is actually you can generate the system calls or the list of system calls on a per thread basis. Command line switch for that is actually -ff. That means follow each and every thread while it's executing and dump the system calls to separate files. Details are on the man page. That means, especially if you have a heavily multi-threaded program, you can exactly trace what's going on when and where with regards to system calls. Now, the output is quite comprehensive, needless to say, depending on the amount of system calls that a particular thread makes, but it's quite handy because, as I said, especially if you pump the output of Strace into a file, you can then use your ordinary, say, tools like AWK, fgrep, or the general grep family in order to sift through that output and to make sure that you get the information that you want. For example, if you're just interested in the files that a particular program is opening, you just grep for the open statements in the Strace output, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. If you have a closed loop software, then it comes in rather handy. See what it's actually doing. Indeed.
Exactly. So Strace, going to the extreme, you can regard Strace as a poor man's first step to reverse engineering a piece of software, if you want to take a close look at what's happening inside. Oh, if you're so inclined. Needless to say, kids. Exactly. Needless to say, kids, don't try this at home unless you're a trained professional.
Like a kernel engineer.
As Martin has found out quite a few times in the past, yes.
No, Strace is really easy to use, right? It's just, you would only use it, I've only used it when dealing with proprietary software to find out.
So Martin, when did you last use Strace?
Oh, that's probably about 10 years ago, yeah.
Okay.
Not my daily activity, indeed. Yeah.
Full disclosure, Martin is now working for a company that deals with what? Black magic, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much. And it's not in the business of ripping off Postgres code. No, certainly not.
Well, the other thing.
Full disclosure.
An open source project like Redis is that you don't need it either, really, do you?
Well, it depends on what you it depends on what you want to do, right?
Well, the source code's available, so would you
need yes
to trace it?
Indeed.
Okay. So not that useful for open source software.
Another joke had backfired, but that's okay. No worries. Full disclosure, people, for those few listeners who haven't listened to the backup log, Martin and myself used to work for Redis Labs. And of course, Redis Labs, being the home of Redis, this kind of in-memory NoSQL database thing. Okay.
Thing is a good word, yes.
Thing, yes, indeed. That nicely, this thing brings us nicely, I think, to the next component. Which is, of course, something called the Berkeley Packet Filter. What do you know about the BPF?
Well, it's got two parts, right? The extended bit and the non-extended bit. Can't remember what the non-extended bit is useful. But, there's a lot of people raving about BPF. But
any idea why?
Because they like it.
Yes.
Well, you can still
Martin, like Martin, yeah. Martin, you being the very old guy here, does D-Trace ring a bell? Going back to the olden Sundays, yes.
Yeah, that is too long ago.
I think it was first implemented in Solaris, right?
Yeah.
Or even SunOS.
So BPF.
Have you ever used D-Trace, Martin?
Well, yes, but that would have been another 30 years.
About what? 30 years ago? Yes. if a vague recollection of things is still present, what can you remember about D trays? In contrast to S trays and L trays and all the rest of them of these things.
Well, it's more like it was more of a that would have been used in an academic setting, whereas S trays and stuff had some practical use.
I mean, D-trace really allowed to instrument the kernel interface to the extent that you actually you could use expressions, for example, in contrast to S-trace that doesn't allow this. Could use expressions to filter, for example, the monitoring functionality of data being passed to the kernel and coming back. So in contrast to S-trace, where you simply can capture all the files that are opened and the file names and all the rest of them, D-trace would allow you to say, now look, I'm just interested in files under this particular directory. Or I just want to know the files who are opened by a child process of the main program and all the rest of them. So the idea behind D-trace was to give you a programmable level that S-trace simply doesn't support.
Yeah.
And there have been quite a few attempts being made to port D-trace to Linux. I think, if I'm not completely mistaken, most of them failed. But then the Berkeley packet filter came to the rescue. Mm. The Berkeley packet filter, of course, being the next generation implementation of something called IP tables, as in the lower level firewall built into the kernel. And originally, the hint is actually in the name Berkeley packet filter. The original implementation was geared at filtering packets in the kernel as part of the network stack. But, and this is where the extended bit comes in, essentially BPF or eBPF these days is a low-level virtual machine running inside the kernel, which has its own instruction set. LLVM and GCC support these, or supports this instruction set. So you can simply write a C-like program that simply talks to that virtual machine, or rather is executed inside the kernel on this virtual machine. And that exactly allows you to do similar things that only before that D-trace was able to do, like to instrument the stuff that is, or the monitoring functionality on top of the kernel, if that makes sense.
Yeah, before, right, you'd have to use various kernel probes and stuff to get that information before, right? And I think BPF makes that a lot easier.
Yes, there are, of course, with the corresponding toolchain, and details are, of course, as usual in the show notes, you have various predefined kernel probes at your disposal, but of course, you can modify them, you can write your own stuff. So, for example, there was at some stage on one of my servers a somewhat misconfigured, I can't even remember what it was, I think Mailman instance that generated some spurious log directory in var. And for the hell of it, I couldn't figure out which component of the Mailman 3 installation that was. So I basically did a kernel probe that would capture a specific path of this log file, as in var logs, and would then capture the PID. So I would exactly know, and during the course of a couple of weeks, I would exactly know which process created this file and what the executable attached to this PID was. And that, of course, would give me a hint of what component of the Mailman 3 installation was actually in charge of creating this particular subdirectory, which comes in handy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty handy. When have you last used? Interesting. If you look at if you have a piece of software you want to trace it, use S-trace and friends. But you're saying you can use eBPF as well. But normally you would write your own. piece of code. Right?
Well, strace and ltrace is bound to the execution of a particular executable, and it's possibly generate child process, but the BP or the extended Burkle packet filter and the toolchain surrounding it basically allows you to monitor a system completely in terms of it's not bound to an executable. The kernel probes allow you basically to specify your conditions and the rest is up to you. So it gives you that level of flexibility that S and ltrace simply don't.
Right. Okay. I haven't used EPPF, but, from what I understood is it's more you write your own piece of code that you then get your stats on.
Exactly. So the idea is basically to use C-like language, which is, as a matter of fact, pretty close to C, to write your kernel probes and all the rest of it. There are a huge number of examples coming with tools like BCC, as in the Berkeley compiler collection, I think it's called. Details are again in the show notes. So you basically simply take a look at what's out there and simply modify that to your heart's content. And of course, you just not are you 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 simply not bound to see as the native language. There's also a Python binding available. That is supported by Python 2 and Python 3 right out of the box.
Okay, so say you are you want to start adding to the Linux kernel. What tools will you use?
First, let's start with your brain, I reckon.
Nah.
So Martin will never be a proper kernel programmer, I suppose.
No.
Well, I mean, yes. You take you simply go to kernel.org and pull down the existing source, and then you take a look at the particular subsystem where you want it, that you want to extend or add a subsystem or whatever, and you do it, of course, in C.
Yeah, now, my point is really that if, you know, fine, that's your first, yes, you need to start writing some programs and things, but you really understand the pieces of the kernel and when they are running, then this is where today's subject comes in, right, with the various abilities to trace.
Now, kernel tracing is a completely, well, I wouldn't say completely different matter, but there's a separate tool set available for in kernel tracing. The idea is, of EBPF and friends is rather to give you a perspective of what's happening between the user land and the kernel. So yeah, it's good more towards the application programmer, if you will.
Yeah, I understand. Yeah, so, but if you want to take that a step further and say, oh, my program is, doing these system calls, how does that execute in the kernel, right? So you may want to go one step further, potentially.
Well, of course, you start with strace, and then, of course, for the more complex stuff, there's always the EBPF at your disposal in Linux, or tools like dtrace on other operating systems.
Yeah. Okay.
And this is what? Almost an hour done of the remaining four.
Four.
Oh, maybe I got that wrong. I don't know. Anything else basically we should cover on this, Mark, before we close off the show?
Yeah, I think. I mean, not so low level kernel user or Linux user. I mean, strace is the tool to use if you want to find out what any piece of software is doing. Right? In summary, if you want to go develop in C or programs, languages like that, then use your EBPFs and tools like that. Any other summaries that you would like to add to this?
Well, GDB and LLDB would be kind of, I reckon, your first go-to tools if you're talking about software that you are.
Yeah,
yes, if you or somebody else has written this, but especially the EBPF and friends come in handy if you want to take a look at. And modern operating systems like Linux can be pretty complex with regards to mail daemons, printers, subsystems, all the rest of it. This is basically where EBPF and friends really shine in terms of if you want to know what's happening when and where outside the ecosystem of your own or somebody else developed software in terms of a complete system. This is basically where these tools really shine.
Okay, yeah, that's a handy overview. And yeah, as you said, if you are like yourself writing software for embedded systems, then you're going to end up having to use these things.
Absolutely. And of course, well, EBPF is available, I think, since kernel 3.something, 4.something. So it's been around for a while. Okay.
Excellent. Well, that was a very nice insight of how to find out what runs and how.
Yes. And before I forget, Martin, now's probably the time to again pick up the poxes and the anti-poxes.
Okay, cool.
So, Martin, what's your pox of the week? Yes.
Okay, so my pox of the week is a book.
A book? Okay.
And it's called Weapons of Math Destruction.
Weapons of Math Destruction.
Indeed.
Like equations and stuff. And functions and algebras and whatever.
Math is short for mathematics. Yeah.
I get this, yes.
Okay, good. Glad to hear.
So I'm just wondering, why do you want to destruct math?
No. So this is a book that is really talking about how math is being misused in algorithms, in, you know, other likes of Google's, Amazon's, any, and other companies out there. And it's a good read.
Okay.
Because obviously...
Details on the show notes.
With statistics, you can prove anything you want.
Can you? I wouldn't know about that. That user land stuff, no.
So yeah, that's my pox. What is your pox of the week?
Pox of the week? Probably... I think we never mentioned this, but Audacity comes pretty close. Because this is software that we use to produce the show. Okay. And you can say whatever you want about Audacity. But it has been and will be probably for the time we make this podcast. A very handy tool. Indeed. Also, and the post-production department just loves it. Never mind how many teams Martin actually fires and are recruit. But that's probably beside the point. They all use Audacity, yes. So that would be my pox of the week. And your anti-pox, Martin.
I think I know what your anti-pox is. Does it start with a J, perhaps?
It does, yes. Funny that you mentioned that. Yeah, my anti-pox of the week would be Jitsi. And particularly Jitsi maintainers, if you're listening, please make sure that your documentation is up to scratch, especially when it comes down to the more advanced configurations options of the video bridge and the meeting software and all the rest of it. It's not great. Full disclosure, people, we are just in the process of migrating a Big Blue Button instance to something called Jitsi Meet. I thought it was straightforward, especially with the new version 2 that apparently saw the light of the day earlier this year. We're recording this at the end of 2020. But when we started this podcast about almost a year ago, I took a look at what's out there, Open Meetings, Jitsi, Big Blue Button, all the rest of them. And let's suffice it to say, eventually we landed at Big Blue Button, but this is now showing the signs of the time. Time? Doesn't matter. So we wanted to take a second look at what's out there, and I thought Jitsi had improved with the latest version, but suffice it to say, there's still a lot of room for improvement. Let's put it this way. Yeah, Martin, what's your anti-pox?
Where does that lead us? Okay, this is a subject for a different podcast.
Yes. Stay tuned for the for the episode 24 where we will all reveal about Jitsi meat. That episode will only, by the way, be about 5 hours long and will basically contain all the details of our fruitless attempts to get this up and running. No, I'm kidding. I'm sure it has its merits, but it's just hard to install. That's all.
Right. How long does it take you again?
The episode or installing it?
Well, I imagine they're both of equal length. Yeah. All right. So my antipox is, I only have a
GPUs?
No. It is really... different formats for transmitting video data these days.
Okay.
On a physical level, which is very annoying. When your laptop doesn't have a display port.
When your laptop doesn't have what?
A display port.
A display port, okay, yes.
But yeah, these things keep moving and having different versions, and you can do DisplayPort over USB-C, and then there's again the different depending where your system supports it and which version is running, and 1.4 and 2.0 and different specs and different. And it's all very annoying anyway. We just like things to work generally.
Indeed, we do. And yes, Jitsi people, that was a hint.
We get the
Or as Snow White used to say in a recent musical, get this shit done. Okay, and with that, I think we are almost done. As usual, we can be found on HPR. Again, if you're listening, all the best for 2021. We will continue to be hosted on this platform until further notice. We would like to thank the great community out there of people who just keep improving Linux and the surrounding ecosystem for their great work. The tools we discussed in this episode are probably just the best examples for this. And we will be, of course, what's what I'm looking for? Yes, we will be looking for sponsors. So if you want to send money our way, buy t-shirts or yes. And of course, we are always looking for feedback. So the email address, yes, is feedback@linuxinlaws.eu, and the address to send any cash or other entities our way with regards to sponsoring the show is of course sponsor@linuxinlaws.eu. And with that, see you around. This is the Linux Inlaws.
You come for the knowledge,
but stay for the madness.
Thank you for listening.
This podcast is licensed under the latest version of the Creative Commons license, type attribution share alike. Credits for the intro music go to Blue Sea Roosters for their song Salute Margaret, to Twin Flames for their piece called The Flow, used for the segment intros, and finally to Celestial Ground for their song Sweet Justice, used by the Dark Side. You find these and other ditties licensed under CC at Jamendo, a website dedicated to liberate the music industry from choking copyright legislation and other crap concepts.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.